Thank you, everybody, for joining us today on this podcast. My name is Elizabeth Zhang. I'm one of the transplant hepatologists at the University of California, San Francisco. And I'm really pleased and honored that one of my colleagues, Dr. Neem Ha, who's also a transplant hepatologist, is joining us today to educate us a little bit more about MASLD. And so, Dr. Ha will be telling us what MASLD stands for, what the definition is, and then we'll go a little bit more into risk factors for MASLD, how we screen and diagnose, and ultimately how we manage and treat MASLD. So thank you, Dr. Ha, so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm just quite honored. So I think that MASLD really stands for metabolic dysfunction that's associated with steatotic liver disease. It's a really new name where it used to be called NAFL or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And it really recurs to a condition where excess fat builds up in the liver in people who really have metabolic symptoms, such as obesity, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. And over time, the liver fat can really cause inflammation as well as damage, which can then lead to more serious problems downstream, causing scarring, which is fibrosis, and then cirrhosis, and eventually liver cancer. Really, the terminology matters because it better reflects what the actual root cause is, which is metabolic syndrome. And MASLD highlights really that this is a liver disease that is really linked closely to other conditions such as obesity, insulin resistance, as well as high blood pressure. And it really helps doctors as well as patient talk more clearly about the problems as well as how to reduce the stigma and the confusion. And for us, I think in terms of a public health urgency, it's a big issue because there's such a large number of population or people who is infected with this. It occurs in about 1 to 3 to 4 adults, and in those with diabetes can up to happen 1 to 2. And it importantly, it doesn't really present with symptoms until they progress, in which we're trying to prevent that. The name metabolic dysfunction is really key because it's very closely linked to the metabolic disease. It shares risk factors, just heart disease, the obesity, as well as type 2 diabetes. And it's just not really a liver issue. It's really bigger than that. And I think that for primary care doctors, it means that the liver health is important to understand in the sense that liver health should be sort of routinely discussed earlier in our patients' lives so that way they don't present to us when they have advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis.
Yeah, that's very important because it seems like with obesity and diabetes, all of these metabolic risk factors on the rise, one would expect that MASLD is on the rise too. And so managing diabetes and other metabolic risk factors is also like managing MASLD. One thing that I wanted to touch on before we move forward is that, so correct me if I'm wrong, MASLD is a relatively new terminology, right? I think before we used to categorize these patients under NAFLD, which we're no longer using. And so, can you just give me a little bit more background as to why we should no longer use that old terminology and why we should switch to using MASLD?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to what we initially said. I think that the MASLD is really more characteristic and better characterizes our patients with this being a metabolic disease. It really focused, again, the real driver of disease, metabolic problems that we talked about, insulin resistance, as well as obesity and also lipid abnormalities. And really, the name change also reduces the stigma and improved clarity. And really, instead of defining the disease by what it isn't, which is alcohol, and now really defining what it really means, linking it to metabolic health. Really the only new addition to this umbrella term, steatotic liver disease, is metabolic associated alcohol associated liver disease, or otherwise MET-ALD. It really depends on the level or degree of alcohol consumption in men, which is, I think, weekly from 210 to 420 grams, or daily 30 to 60 grams. And for women, it's approximately 140 to 350 grams per week, or 20 to 50 grams per day. And the degree of alcohol consumption, you could have more predominantly alcohol associated versus more predominantly metabolic syndrome, depending on how much metabolic risk factors they have, and then predominantly metabolic dysfunction. And we try to simplify this as much as we can, mainly just to help the primary care providers in diagnosing patients with this. And really is when they have fat or steatosis on imaging or on biopsies, and just only one out of five main metabolic risk factors. And that can include really waist circumferences as well as BMI. And they characterize BMI as really greater than 23 for Asians or 25 for non-Asians. And you have just impaired fasting glucose or pre-type 2 diabetes or diabetes and hypertension or elevated lipids in terms of triglycerides or low HDL. It's really just trying to simplify this process and really find these patients earlier on for the primary care provider.
Yeah, that's great. So it seems like this new terminology, MASLD, is much more descriptive, and definitely is helpful for our patients in that it's not as stigmatizing. And then lastly, it's very helpful for, I think, everybody in the medical community to simplify MASLD diagnosis, and hopefully we'll be able to diagnose it more too. And can you just tell me a little bit more, in terms of the diagnostic tools that you use when you see a patient in your clinic who has presumed MASLD?
Yeah, so the first thing is really how to identify these patients. I think that we kind of highlight some of the diagnostic criteria and how who do we screen. So we worry about the patients who have associated risk factors such with obesity. And the reason why this is important is because fat around the internal organs causes inflammation and insulin resistance. And the type 2 diabetes, dyslipidemia, hypertension is really all that metabolic cascade that again impairs glucose metabolism as well as fat deposition, therefore causing inflammation. And then we also look at those patients who have sedentary lifestyles, unhealthy diet. The risk factors when we screen for patients before we go into the diagnostic is important in the sense that who are the ones at risk? I would say the ones who have diabetes just because the prevalence is so high. And also even racial ethnicity, such as the Hispanic population. And the Hispanic population compared to non-Hispanic has a 1.5 higher relative risk with a prevalence even up to 41%. And for these, sometimes they're linked to genetic as well as environmental factors, one genetic being the PNPLA3. And also people with metabolic syndrome we talked about. And the other thing is people who have maybe limited access to sort of food in terms of social determinants of health who may have risk factors for unhealthy diet or lifestyle. So once we identify these at-risk population, I think that sometimes the imaging modality that people kind of go on to the most is really ultrasound. And I think ultrasound is a common first test to really detect fat in the liver with a pretty good sensitivity and a good specificity as well. And once we identify the ultrasound, we don't really stop there. We have to identify what is the degree of fibrosis. And this is where our primary care providers really can come in and help. Just because they're the first line. And usually most of the screening tests that they use is the FIB-4 score. And the FIB-4 score is really this non-invasive scoring modality that includes age, liver enzymes, as well as platelets. And it was initially developed for our hepatitis C population, but it's been adapted to our MASLD population. And I do think that it's really important to note for our primary care listeners are the age between where FIB-4 is most reliable is really age 35 to 65, mainly because age is part of the numerator in the equation and it can cause sort of overestimation. So I would say for patients who are over 65, we can be more generous with a cutoff of, say, 2 rather than 1.3. And then the other thing that we can also consider as non-invasive is really this new score called, I believe it was, enhanced liver fibrosis, the ELF or ELF score, as well as newer modality that really can use as a primary care or even a specialist for patients who may not have access to imaging modality, where it looks at different moleculars or molecules associated with collagen deposition or scarring, aka fibrosis. So we do the non-invasive tests and then the imaging modality. I think we have another podcast just separately for that just because it's so much data that's around that. But I would say for the listeners, ultrasound is really the easier ones. And then the FibroScan of your community or your institution has it can be really helpful just because it's fast is accurate, has good data to support looking at the contents of the fat in the liver, as well as the severity of the scarring, which is really the most important part when we think about outcomes and prognosis. And then when you look at different other imaging or aka elastography, it can come in a variety of like ultrasound, CTs, MRIs. I think that is really important when we order that and when we read the interpretation, we understand that each of these modalities have different liver stiffness cutoff. So those are kind of the earlier tests I would recommend using.
Okay. And so I always sometimes get a little bit confused as to how often we should be checking these labs and calculating the FIB4 and getting ultrasounds. Do you have any guidance, particularly if patients are being seen in this primary care setting, and so maybe they're only being seen like once a year for annual checkup and otherwise are feeling well? How often should we be recommending these tests?
That's a great question. So I think that for our primary care providers, I think, we've identified the at-risk population first, and we have great guidelines out. You can follow either AGA, ACG, or even AASLD guidelines. And I would talk maybe more specifically for AASLD, given that they provide recommendation in terms of intervals. So for our patients, they who don't have type 2 diabetes, and may have maybe less than 2 metabolic risk factors, the recommendation is really to screen for FIB4 every 2 to 3 years. And for those who have type 2 diabetes and maybe have more metabolic risk factors, then the recommendation is more frequently where you can get a FIB4 score or labs to calculate the FIB4 score every 1 or 2 years. And then if any of those FIB4 score, depending on what the caveat of the age that we talked about, has intermittent risk or high risk, that's the time where we use a second modality in terms of using either a imaging-based elastography, aka a FibroScan, or a serum-based risk score like the ELF score.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so it doesn't seem like we need to do it that frequently. And for the most part, we can depend on blood work to help us at least stratify, risk stratify who needs more evaluation or even a referral to a specialist. Okay, I just want to shift a little bit to talking more about management of MASLD and treatment. Recognizing that we don't have a lot of time to spend on this very big topic, but maybe just starting with lifestyle modifications that you recommend to your patients, particularly when it comes to weight loss, nutrition, and physical activity.
Treatment for MASLD, for any metabolic risk factors or syndrome, it all starts with our lifestyle. It's a cornerstone of managing metabolic syndrome or MASLD. And it's really the most effective way to reduce liver fat inflammation, therefore reducing downstream scarring, aka fibrosis. And really, there's not really a single modality that really treats and fixes everything, but I do think we have good data in terms of weight. Let's talk about weight first. I think weight loss is again the foundation of treating MASLD, and this will also explain the downstream kind of recommendations I also give to my patient, including pharmacological as well as surgical. And if we reduce weight, the ultimate goal is preventing disease progression, with the goal of really improving, resolving fat in the liver, and then more importantly, preventing the scarring deposition or fibrosis, with the ultimate goal of trying to regress it if we can. There's been great studies out there, but I would say that even a weight loss of 5 to 7% when you're counseling your patient, you can say that for people who achieve even up to 5 to 7%, there's almost a two-third improvement in the fat in the liver, as well as maybe one half regression of scarring. And for those who achieve greater than 10%, that percentage even increased further, 100% with reduction of fat and up to 81% reduction or regression of scarring. However, weight loss is definitely more simple said than done. In terms of the majority of people who actually achieve up to 7 to 10% of weight loss for just lifestyle dietary modification, it's unfortunately less than 10%. And even less than that actually is able to sustain it for over 1 year. So in terms of like the weight, how can we lose weight in terms of lifestyle? I think dietary we can talk about different dietary, but the ones that are probably the most well studied is the Mediterranean diet, just because it's rich in vegetables, it's healthy fats like olive oil, or lean proteins, as well as whole grains. But for patients who may not have, have social determinants of health in terms of maybe not able to afford this diet, we can recommend just a reduction of 30% of caloric intake, just to make it easier to reduce, again, these food consumption. And also to think about low-hanging recommendations, we can tell the patients to reduce sugar, as well as maybe the fructose, sodas, fruit juices, and really processed food like carbs. And then we think about dietary in addition to that, we think about exercise. And for me, I always ask the patient, what kind of exercise do you do? So that way I can help categorize them in terms of moderate or vigorous, and not just give them a overlying recommendation just to work out. I want them to give them, identifiable goals and target. So one of your patient has, they like to garden or like to walk. That's considered moderate, versus another patient who likes to run, who likes to bike, who likes to swim, which is more vigorous. And I tell them, like, look, if you have moderate exercise, all you really need to do is have 150 to 200 minutes per week. And if you have vigorous exercise, all you need to do is have 75 to 150 minutes per week to really have this big effect in terms of, fatty liver resolution, as well as the regression of the scarring. And I really emphasize that even though we target weight, and if they don't achieve that weight loss that they, have in mind, but still meet this moderate and vigorous exercise goal, there's still good data there that also improves the liver health, regardless if that weight loss is achieved.
Yeah, I think that's a great point in that the focus should be on getting good nutrition and increasing physical activity levels rather than so much on weight loss, because it can be pretty defeating for patients if they are not able to lose a certain amount of weight. And we know that weight loss and these lifestyle modifications are lifelong, so it's not like we should put a 1 year timestamp on this and they have to achieve a certain amount. Are there so obviously we hear a lot about Ozempic and Wegovy, Mounjaro, these types of GLP-1s that are very popular these days and are also very effective in managing weight loss as well as diabetes. What are your thoughts on starting a patient on that type of treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the data that is available for GLP-1, which is glucagon-like peptide ones or GIPs, or otherwise glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptides, it's very rich for especially patients with metabolic, dysfunction, in addition to the fatty liver. I would say after dietary, after lifestyle, that we have really exhausted sort of everything that we can to help them achieve their weight goal, or their ALT goal, or whatever goal that they have in mind, and they're still unable to achieve it after 6 to 12 months, that's when I also think about sort of maybe introducing pharmacological therapies. Now, in caveat is, if those patients that we see at a later stage, maybe my threshold to start them on these therapies are actually lower, just because they may not have enough time, and I really want to prevent any further disease progression. So let's talk about the GIP as well as the GIPs. We have, I think, the two common ones that people are commonly used is semaglutide, which is a GLP-1, and tirzepatide, which is a dual agonist GLP-1 and GIP. And how the GIP, the these two incretins really works is they are able to improve insulin sensitivity, reduce liver fat, and potentially really slows down the progression of fibrosis. So really, everything that we really want in our patients. And the GLP-1s is a hormone that really our body naturally makes after it releases after we eat, and it stimulates that insulin sensitivity secretion, suppresses the glucagon release, which really helps prevent the rise of blood sugars, and it also slows the gastric emptying. Therefore, it gives that patient that early satiety feeling where they may not feel the need to eat as much. The GIP-1 is also again an incretin hormone that stimulates the insulin release, and it also works a little different from the GLP-1s in its effects on glucagon and fat deposition. And there's recent studies on the cardiology side that also these agents have also reduced cardiovascular events. And that is really big in our population, given that our patients who have fatty liver disease, their risk is still cardiovascular, let alone their liver health in the future. And I would say, when you look at the trials, we can start with the semaglutide first. And then semaglutide, or the brand name, Ozempic or Wegovy, depending on the indication for diabetes or weight loss, respectively, it can reduce 60% of the inflammation in the liver after 72 weeks, and it can also improve 40% of the scarring in the liver after 72 weeks. The tirzepatide, which is the trade name Mounjaro or Zepbound, that can also be shown in clinical trials to reduce about 60% of the fat inflammation in the liver, and also up to 50% reduction in overall scarring. So for my patients, I would say I would try to, again, order the correct indication, depending on if it's type 2 diabetes. And if they don't have type 2 diabetes, there will be more of the weight loss indication, and really to try to appeal and try to get them on these agents in order to improve not just their liver, but also their cardiovascular health.
Okay, great. I mean, this is a really great overview of screening, diagnosis, and management of MASLD. If providers wanted to read a little bit more about the actual guidelines, are there certain resources they can go to or resources that you go to kind of help figure out what the next step might be for a certain patient?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of centric guidelines or information. Usually I recommend that patients to either go to, there's patient education on the New England Journal website, as well as also the Maine Society website. So this can be found in the AASLD. They have some information for patients, as well as ACG and AGA. And then for the primary care providers, there's so many good resources in terms of the family medicine societies. And Liz, I think I'm going to edit this, but maybe ask me about the resmetirom.
Yeah, I didn't want to put it in this. So the next
Okay.
podcast
Okay.
is a case study, which I think we should,
Okay,
yeah.
perfect. Awesome.
Okay. So I'm just going to wrap up now. Okay. So thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Ha. I'm just going to wrap up our podcast. And I'd also like to introduce our next podcast, which focuses more on a case study. So I'm going to present to you a patient that I've actually been following in my clinic, but I just want to get some more clarity as to one, making sure if I'm doing the right thing, and then also just kind of walking everybody through the steps of how these patients with MASLDs are being managed in a specialty hepatology clinic. But I just want to summarize today's podcast. So mainly I want to focus on we've shifted away from using terminology like NAFLD or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease to more descriptive terminology like MASLD, so metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease. Even though it's a mouthful, if you really think about it, it's a much more descriptive term for this clinical condition, and it's a lot less stigmatizing. I also want to thank you for kind of going through who we should be screening and how you can diagnose MASLD. And thankfully, MASLD diagnosis is much more simplified now. So basically, if you have a patient who has imaging characteristics for steatosis in the liver and they have a metabolic risk factor like obesity or diabetes, high cholesterol, or high blood pressure, then you can essentially diagnose them with MASLD, right? Okay, great. And then in terms of counseling for MASLD, it sounds like the cornerstone is really lifestyle modifications between nutrition and physical activity levels. Obviously, we encourage weight loss, but we don't want to make that seem like it's the end all be all because that can be very discouraging for patients. And then there are great medications available now for the treatment of diabetes as well as for weight loss management that you have highlighted. And in our next podcast that focuses on an actual patient, we're going to be reviewing additional medications specifically approved for the treatment of MASLD with some degree of fibrosis in the liver. So I hope you'll be able to join us for this next podcast.